Support comes from St. Louis Public Library Foundation, helping the library serve children and their families with programs and services needed to become lifelong readers. More information about the foundation is at slpl.org.
This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Not many people can say they've traveled to every country on the globe. St. Louis-raised Sam Goodwin is one of them, but he bears distinction for another reason. In 2019, while visiting Syria, Sam was seized by the Assad regime, held in the notorious Syrian prison system for 63 days, and miraculously released. Sam joined us on the show back in January this year when he was still working on a book about that experience. That work, titled Saving Sam, the true story of an American's disappearance in Syria and his family's extraordinary fight to bring him home, is out today. And here to share more about the book and what's in it, we have Sam Goodwin. Sam, welcome back to the show.
Elaine, thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
So, Sam, all the countries in the world, why travel in that way?
Yeah, from 2010 to 2020, I traveled every country in the world, and it all began very organically. I spent the majority of those 10 years living and working overseas in Singapore and Dubai, and just a personal preference as I traveled on weekends and holidays. I just didn't like to repeat places. And in early 2018, I realized that I had been to about 120 countries in the world. And at that point, I remember thinking, well, how many are there? And maybe I could go to all of them. But for me, travel originally was never about ticking boxes or checking places off the list. Travel was the best education I've ever had, and that was really the basis for this journey.
Mm-hmm. Now, Syria, Sam, has long been perilous for Syrians, let alone tourists. Now, you did not go in with a cavalier attitude. You took precautions, but you were detained by the military there. At what point did you know you were in very serious trouble?
One of the most significant things that I had learned through my travels is that places that are negatively perceived, or that Western media tells us we're not supposed to like, these were the places where I had many of my best experiences. And for me on my journey, safety was always the top priority. But truly, many of these places where I had were where my perspectives were most meaningfully impacted. I've camped at the base of Angel Falls in Venezuela. I went to the Olympics in Sochi in Russia. I've coached North Korea's national hockey team. I celebrated New Year's Eve on Kish Island in Iran. And despite all of the instability that was happening in Syria, I was confident that the same would be the case. And when I arrived on May 25th, 2019, that was not the case. About 2 hours after arriving, I was walking through a roundabout on the way to meet up with my guide when all of a sudden a black pickup truck abruptly pulled up next to me. Two armed men jumped out of the back seat and instructed me to get inside. And as we sped down back alleys of the city, the officers in the vehicle, they accused me of espionage, of being an American spy and collaborating with terrorists. And nothing like this anywhere else had ever happened to me before. And this was the moment, to answer your question, when I really felt like something was wrong.
Mm-hmm. So it was pretty immediate.
It was just a few hours after I arrived.
Now, you were held, Sam, in solitary confinement in Branch 215, and that's a prison in the outskirts of Damascus known for its brutal and lethal treatment of many thousands of people. What was that prison like? You know, how did it look and smell? How did it make you feel?
I was stunned and in disbelief about what had happened. In just a few short hours, my life had spiraled out of control in the most terrifying of ways. I felt exactly the way they wanted me to, hopeless, utterly cut off from any control of my life. And I was put in a cell that was all concrete. It had no windows. I had nothing but a small blanket to lay on the concrete floor as a bed. The only human interaction I had was for a few seconds in the morning and evening when the guards brought bread and boiled potatoes and water. And I remained here in solitary confinement for 27 days.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that you you felt immediately you wore contacts. So the disorientation that comes with being unable to see, not only see your way out, but to actually see the things around you. What was that like for you?
So I wear extended wear contacts, and a few weeks after being there, they expired. And so I wasn't able to really see anymore. But interestingly, that wasn't a huge issue because all I was looking at was four cell walls all day. But those did expire, and it just became one more thing to deal with in that situation.
Yeah. Now, one thing that you wrote about in the book was that it was especially difficult in prison not to know what day it was, or even to know what time of day it was. How is it that you counted the days in prison, and what made that so instrumental to maintaining some presence of mind?
I learned pretty quickly that maintaining a connection to the outside world was incredibly important. And I did this by two ways, kept track of days by two ways. One was I had to request to go to the bathroom, and I would sometimes be allowed to. And the bathroom was just this small hole in the concrete floor a few steps outside the cell door. But from that hole, I could look up and see this small window to the outside. And I started to try to time my bathroom requests with when I thought there was a change from day to night, mm-hmm. so that I could confirm what I was thinking. And then the other way was I started to identify a pattern or a schedule on when the minimal food was being brought. So I started to think, okay, I think I'm getting this in roughly the morning and getting this roughly in the evening, and would kind of cross-reference that information with my bathroom visits. And then I chipped a rock off the cell wall, and I carved a calendar into the wall and would mark off days and keep track. And I found that maintaining this connection and understanding of the days and keeping track of days was one of the most important ways to remaining emotionally and psychologically in tune. And a lot of these details are recapped in the book.
Right. Another thing that you struggled with was control. You know, you're in a place where your fate was in the hands of other people. What else did you do to maintain some strength in those initial days? You know, was there a routine that you put in place for yourself to achieve that?
So I sometimes say to people, and I'll say to you, Elaine, if I told you that you were going to go and be in an underground Syrian prison for 27 days in solitary confinement, you were going to eat bread and boiled potatoes and water. You were going to hear people being tortured, but you're not going to be physically harmed, but you'll be emotionally tortured. And on day 27, you'll be released. I'm not saying that you'd be comfortable, mm-hmm. but I will say that you'd be in a totally different situation having that finish line and knowing the day that it's going to end. The most challenging thing for me was the uncertainty of the situation. Were they going to keep me in that cell forever? Mm-hmm. Based on the information I had, I thought that was possible. Were they going to release me in 5 minutes? I thought that was possible. Were they going to release me in a week? Were they going to stop feeding me or torture me or just shoot me? Based on the information I had, I believed all of these things were possible, and attempting to entertain all of these options 24/7 was emotionally and psychologically exhausting. And to answer your question, I found strength in that cell in several ways, but three key ways that I talk about quite a bit were, number one, perhaps, but paradoxically, was to lean into gratitude. Mm-hmm. Number two was to focus on controlling the things that I could control. And number three was to recognize the uncertainty of that situation as an opportunity for growth. And these are actually things that I talk quite a bit about today in the wake of this situation. In addition to those three things, nothing was more important than my faith, and I leaned on that more significantly than anything else. And what I learned in solitary confinement is that we're never less alone than when we're totally alone with God. So I was finding strength in lots of different ways in solitary confinement.
Mm-hmm. We're going to come back to that a little bit later, because the solitary confinement part, after a few weeks, that is no longer the situation you're in. You're moved to another facility called Adra Prison. And this was an upgrade because you're not alone any longer, and you befriended some people there. Is there an interaction, Sam, that shows what kinds of relationships you were able to forge with your prison mates?
Being at ADRA, as you mentioned, was unquestionably an upgrade from solitary confinement. It did have its own challenges, though, with no privacy and having to manage various relationships and personalities. But overall, it was positive. The other inmates and I, we became friends. We cooked and shared food together. They taught me Arabic. I taught them English. There was a prison basketball court, and I taught several of them how to play knockout.
Okay.
Knockout? Knockout, a basketball game where you knock people out and the kind of last man standing wins.
Okay.
It taught them that game. These men truly were a remarkable display of humanity and frankly reinforced some of the most significant things that I had learned through my travels, one of them being never judge people by the actions of their government.
Mm-hmm.
I also learned that people who have the least often give the most, something I've found to be true in all corners of the world, including in this situation.
Mm-hmm. And there's a story related to what I had asked about before, the contact lenses that you are no longer able to wear, right?
A couple weeks into this second month, I was I was just having a conversation with a couple of the other guys, and I was frustrated that I wasn't able to see. And they told me that there was actually an eye doctor at the prison. And so they helped me put in a request to go see him. And a week later, I was able to go see him. And he was actually a prisoner himself. But I went to his little area, and he had a machine, this piece of optometry equipment from like the Stone Age. But he did a couple of tests with his machine, and he said that he could order me glasses, and he handed me a receipt. And this was a little bit discouraging because I didn't have any money. I didn't have anything. So I went back to my cell, and a couple of the other inmates were asking me, how did it go? How was the appointment? And I said, well, it was fine, but I'm not going to be getting glasses. And the next morning, they came to me, and they said, Sam, we talked to the eye doctor, and we paid for your glasses, and you should have them in just a couple days.
Mm-hmm.
And the glasses did arrive in just a few days, and being able to see again was one of the brightest moments of my entire captivity and was all a result of the kindness of complete strangers. And I'll just take this quick opportunity to say that one of the challenges that I have with my story is the way that I portray the country of Syria, because throughout my travels to every country, much of the best hospitality I've experienced anywhere in the world has been across the Middle East. And I am confident that if I wouldn't have had this miscommunication in Syria and had this experience, I would have had a fantastic experience with hospitable people as I did everywhere else in the Middle East. And the Syrian people are incredible, and I hope that everyone gets the chance to experience it. And unfortunately, there are sometimes people in charge around the world who cause challenges, but underneath all of that, there are people just like us. And what I've learned is that the overwhelming majority of people in the world are well-intentioned, proud of their country, happy to help others, and that was the case very much in this situation.
Mm-hmm. When it comes to people, there are people back home. And your last conversation with people back home here in St. Louis was just moments before you were arrested. You have hindsight now. At what point might your family have realized how perilous a situation you were in?
When I was kidnapped off the street, I was actually on the phone, on FaceTime with my mother. It was a dropped call, which actually was not uncommon when I traveled to off-the-beaten-track places. But after a couple of days, even just a day or two, my family really started to worry, and essentially the news of my disappearance was learned through me going dark.
And in that time, what were you thinking? Were you worried about your family, or just so in your own sort of situation that was something that you you thought of after some time had passed?
I immediately worried about my family, and as I looked around at the cell walls, I just felt hopelessly out of reach, and I couldn't help but wonder what they would be dealing with, the lack of communication, the just going silent, how they would deal with that and what they would be able to do. But I worried about their health, their state of mind through all of this immediately.
Mm-hmm. Sam, when we spoke with you back in January, you talked mostly about what you experienced. You described the relationships you formed with fellow prisoners in Syria, which you've described a little bit today, too. But in this book, Saving Sam, we get the perspective of others, and particularly of members of your immediate family. Now, one of those perspectives comes from your mother, Anne Goodwin, and a section that struck me describes a meeting with U.S. officials who were part of a team called the Fusion Cell, and your mother's feeling, quote, gutted, that they weren't doing enough to secure your release. Read us a bit of your mom's writing, Sam.
Okay, here we go. So, quote, "Listen, I told them, let's just start over for a minute here. I'm going to ask you questions, and I want you to answer me. Can you tell me why Sam was in Syria in the first place? Is he physically fit? Do you even know his story?" The Fusion Cell then made a striking comment to us, but in a matter-of-fact tone. "If you want your son home, you are going to have to find an influencer of President Assad, someone who can plead his case," they said. A couple of weeks before this, I hadn't even known exactly who President Assad was. Now, I said to myself in disbelief, is the U.S. government asking us to find a person who can personally exert influence on the president of Syria? In the awkward silence that followed, one of the officials spoke up. Quote, "You really need to manage your expectations," she said. "You may never see Sam alive again."
That it's an excerpt. It was edited for clarity from your book. Go ahead.
But learning about everything that happened on the outside while I was trapped on the inside has been overwhelming. And it's 5 years later today, as I've written this book and reflected and met a lot of these people, it's 5 years later and I'm still saying thank you to people. And I'll say that the people who my family worked with, it's not as if our public servants are ill-equipped or ill-intentioned. And a lot of some of the negativity or what's communicated here was just a result of frustration and being an intense situation. And all these people who worked on my case, I've become friends with in the aftermath, and they're fantastic people. But the book does go into this frustration and the challenges that my family had working with the U.S. government, who was well-intentioned, wanting to help, but was essentially just handcuffed by the political situation and a lack of diplomatic ties.
Mm-hmm. We need to take a quick break here, but we'll be back shortly to continue this conversation. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
Welcome back. Let's return to our conversation with Sam Goodwin. In 2019, Sam was detained and held in the notorious Syrian prison system for 63 days. His book about the experience and the international network of people who worked to get him out and back to his family in St. Louis is titled Saving Sam, and it's out today. Sam, before the break, we were talking about the U.S. government, its role, what it could would not do to facilitate your release. And really, something that is at the heart of this book is the power of connections. So your family reached out to dozens and dozens of people to try to get you out of Syria. Can you briefly describe the different avenues your family explored or exhausted, you know, the different types of people they tried to enlist to help get you out?
My family persistently pursued several options from the U.S. government, the White House, the FBI, the CIA, the Pentagon, to the Vatican, to Middle East NGOs, private sector security companies, even reaching Russian diplomats. And they had many lines in the water to attempt to find a resolution.
But ultimately, it was a sister's former college roommate who was key to your release. Tell us about that part of the story, Sam.
About 3 weeks in, my younger sister, Stephanie, who was 25 years old at the time, living in Nashville, she particularly became entirely overwhelmed with everything that was happening, and she decided that she needed to call someone and talk to them about this and just blow off some steam, which was against the recommendation of the U.S. government of keeping all the communication very tight. So she decides that she's going to call her former college roommate, who is coincidentally also named Stephanie. So there's this phone call between the Stephanies. And as the story goes, it's, you know, hey, how you doing? And my Steph says, well, actually, things aren't very good. And she goes on to explain, my brother's been missing for weeks. Nobody's heard from him. We're working with all of these agencies, officials. Nobody's been able to help. We're really scared. And roommate Steph was, of course, shocked to hear something like this, but she says all the right things and offers her full support. And at the end of the call, as the story goes, roommate Steph says, hey, if there's anything I can do, just let me know. And my Steph responded almost jokingly or sarcastically. She said, well, unless you know someone who knows Assad, the Syrian president, please just pray. And roommate Steph says, wait, let me call you back. And it turns out that roommate Steph, as you mentioned, Elaine, is Lebanese, and her uncle is good friends with General Abbas Ibrahim, who heads Lebanon's internal security. And General Ibrahim was able to work with his counterpart in Damascus to mediate my release. Mm-hmm. So this was a situation where the FBI, the CIA, President Trump, the Pentagon, Pope Francis was involved, Russian intelligence, Middle East NGOs, were all struggling to be effective. But my sister's college roommate could identify a path to get an American hostage released from captivity. And if you want to learn more about how that's possible, it's in the book.
So as far as the timeline goes, from the time the two Stephanies had their conversation to your eventual release, how much time has elapsed between those two events?
So my entire captivity was 9 weeks. The Stephanie's call was about 3 weeks in, and that really ignited what turned out to be the conclusion of this case. But it took about 6 weeks for things to play out, from being interrogated by the Syrians to being moved to another facility. Also, there was an assassination attempt between kind of political factions in Lebanon that delayed Abbas Ibrahim's kind of rescue mission to come and get me. So there were some things that happened, but ultimately that was the timeline.
Mm-hmm. And how was it that you were released? I mean, what was that moment in which you learned that you would be leaving?
On July 26th, 2019, one of the prison officials came to the cell I was in. He called my name and he indicated that I was being moved. And as he escorted me outside, he stopped and he just said, Sam, you're very lucky. President Assad has agreed to release you. This sounds encouraging, but I had been lied to so many times in the past 2 months that I had essentially become immune to believing anything like this. But they drove me from there out of Damascus and into Beirut. And I learned that General Ibrahim's negotiations had led to President Assad in Syria finally figuring out what had happened and dropping his bogus charges against me. And when I arrived at the Office of Lebanon's General Security, in addition to dozens of government and military intelligence officials and journalists, my parents were there, culminating this moment that was indescribably emotional, one that many people thought would never happen. And frankly, just a breathtaking display of God answering prayers.
Mm-hmm. Did you not believe that it was happening to some extent? I mean, you saw your parents, they were there. But did it take something else to come to accept that this was the reality, that you were no longer going to be held?
When I was being driven out of Syria and into Lebanon, I started to really, when I was driven out of Damascus, I started thinking, you know, this is, I was thinking that like the nice cars, the professional nature of the operation made me think that this was either really good or really bad. I'm about to experience one extreme of the captivity spectrum here, but I didn't know which one it was. When I arrived in Beirut and saw my parents, that was really the moment when I started to think, okay, I actually think this may truly be coming to an end.
Mm-hmm. So this book, it takes an approach that is not just one narrator. I'm speaking with you. You did read something that is attributed to your mother. Why is it that you felt it was important to tell this story from multiple perspectives?
So going back to the office in Beirut, a couple minutes after we were reunited, I was thinking about everything that had happened in the past 9 weeks, and I said to my parents in a somewhat kind of naive way, I said, hey, I have a story for you. And the two of them looked at each other, and then my mom looked back at me and said, well, Sam, we have a story for you too. And what I learned was that while I was trapped on the inside, I had no idea about anything that happened on the outside. And over the past several years, I've been learning about all of these people who worked to help, from people who loved me to people who had no idea who I was, and everywhere in between. And what I've learned is that half of the story wasn't even mine to tell. It's my family's. Mm-hmm. And the way that this book is set up, it's two parallel stories being told in tandem, essentially kind of like it has this Apollo 13-esque structure to it, in the sense that there's this under-resourced entity stuck on the inside and this group of people trying to help. And the difference is that in Apollo 13, they could talk to each other, but essentially that is the structure of the book, and there are two stories being told simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. So in light of other perspectives, I want to go back a few weeks into your imprisonment and bring it back to here and there. A friend in prison also helped you to smuggle out a note to your family to let them know that you were alive. Tell us how that happened.
About 2 weeks into the second month, one of the inmates came to me and he said, hey, Sam, I can get some communication out of this prison. I could get a note out. He had my attention very quickly, and he explained to me that he was going to give his dirty laundry to a friend who was coming to bring him clean laundry, and they were going to swap it out. And he told me that he could hide this note in his dirty laundry. So I wrote something very quickly to my father, where I was, a little bit of information, and I gave it to him, and I never heard anything back. But when I was released, I learned that that note had been sent out to his friend in Damascus, and then from there to that person's contact in the United States. And I didn't know this until later, but my inmate's friend who came to swap out the laundry, when that call was made to the United States, it was made to people who were, of all places, in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And they called my father to tell them that they had a note from Sam. And on the note, it said that I was alive. And it was essentially the first true proof of life that my family had. We didn't know until later that that call was coming to my father from St. Louis, just a few miles away. And it really just shows humanity. It shows how we're all fundamentally well-intentioned people. And it also shows how we're all connected today in the age of technology. And I think it's just this remarkable story of humanity.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Sam Goodwin, who is the St. Louis-raised author of Saving Sam, a book out today that details his disappearance in Syria and his family's fight to bring him home. For someone who's listening to this conversation, you know, you're talking about this book, about multiple perspectives. There are stories that are happening for you and then ones that are happening with your family. And let's be real about family. Not everybody is going to agree about what a narrative is. And something that definitely stood out to me were a couple of sections that feature the Stephanie, your sister, and your brother David. reflecting on very real tensions that existed, even as, you know, the Goodwins as a unit are trying to find out or figure out a way to get you released. Sam, what did the process of writing this book reveal about others' experiences of your imprisonment?
I think specifically David's section is one of the most important sections in this book because it humanizes it. David is a smart person. He's thoughtful. And if he's having these thoughts, then other people probably are too. And I realize that a travel journey to every country in the world isn't for everyone. And there are others who are thinking that too. So I think that that section is incredibly important because it makes it relatable, it humanizes it, but it's also true. These were things that were happening. And I recognize today that my family, sometimes I feel like it's strange because sometimes I feel like what they went through is arguably more challenging and more extraordinary than what I went through. Sometimes I feel like I had the easy part when I learn about everything that had happened, and that's what's in the book. But this tension and everything that went into it is a key part of the story, and I think it will be relatable because if David or others are thinking that, then I think readers will be thinking that too, and that brings people together and is relatable.
And to put a finer point on what that means, it's questioning, why would you go? What are you all supposed to do? What are some of the other challenges that may come to people's mind as they're reading this and thinking about why is it that your family had to go through everything they did?
Sure. Why did Sam want to travel to every country in the world? Why did he want to travel to places that are viewed as dangerous or where something could go wrong? Maybe this was unrealistic in the first place to even go on a journey like this. I think all of these things are natural questions. And this book is an opportunity for me to really share my thoughts, the key events that shaped my life leading up to this, and explain how this all transpired. And that's why so much more can be explained in a book than ever could in a news story or an interview or anything like that, even a podcast. So I'm excited about this opportunity to share more about that and give that perspective because it is so important. And if David and others are thinking that or asking these questions, there will be others who are too, and I'm really happy to have those sections in the book. I think they're some of the most important points in there because they're relatable.
Mm-hmm. You talked about faith earlier, and you write in the book that among your prayers in prison was one that asked God to give you courage to forgive your captors. Why?
I prayed very hard for, as you mentioned, the courage to forgive my captors. And in that situation, I discovered that I was working to forgive people who weren't even sorry. And that's strength. I discovered that forgiveness is not a feeling, it's a choice. And I'm still working on this today, but I found a lot of strength in forgiveness in that situation. And I said to myself, I'm going to do everything I can to forgive these people and sort of cut that tie and control what I can control. But in my view, they still have to answer to God later, and I'll let them deal with that, but I'm going to do my part. And I found a lot of strength in that, particularly in that first month, by really working to forgive them.
Mm-hmm. You grew up Catholic, and faith is that constant we were talking about throughout the story. Was there anything about your non-Catholic, non-Christian prison mates that taught you invaluable lessons about spirituality?
In that second month, I had quite a few conversations with the other inmates about religion, about spirituality, and the majority of them were Muslims and prayed five times a day, and we really bonded over our commitment to our faith. And I think that this is something that can bond people around the world. And I enjoyed learning about Islam. They enjoyed learning more about Christianity and Catholicism. And those conversations were meaningful. And we really, as I mentioned, bonded over this commitment to living our faith every day.
Mm-hmm. Stories abound in this book, but are there any that have added sort of a new meaning to the way you understand and continue to process your experience? And is there a specific example of that?
One thing that comes to mind is just the way that I view challenges today, everyday challenges, big and small. And when I'm facing something, I try to take a step back, put things into perspective, and remain level-headed by using this low point as a foundation for decision-making. Essentially, rock bottom taught me things that a mountaintop never could. And I really try to channel this to others today to reflect on our biggest challenges and how we can use that for strength and perspective in our own challenges going forward.
Mm-hmm. So something I will make sure I ask you about, you are a survivor. There's survivor's guilt. And the U.S. government believes there are half a dozen or so Americans still detained in Syria. And in May, the family of American psychotherapist Majid Kamalmaz found out that he died in custody. So do you feel a measure of that survivor's guilt? And if so, how do you work with and through that?
I don't feel so much survivor's guilt as I feel what I would characterize as survivor's responsibility. I feel like I was given this for a reason. I also view the world through a spiritual lens and believe that God got me out of there for a reason. And Majid Kamalmaz, his family are incredible people. Maryam and Ula, just down the line, incredible people. I've come to know them and done what I can to support them through their heartbreaking situation. But it is important to remember that there are other Americans who are being held, not only in Syria, but in other places around the world as well. And every one of those families is going through the hardest thing that they've ever gone through in their life. So in the wake of this, part of that responsibility has been not only sharing lessons of resilience and gratitude and overcoming uncertainty, but also about supporting these families of others who are being held and trying to share things that my family did, coping strategies, reaching out to various entities and various people, pursuing all these avenues. And essentially, I heard a friend of mine say, who was a former hostage as well, he said that we're part of the most elite club that nobody ever wants to be a part of. Mm. And a group of people that I didn't even know existed, but in this situation, I've tried to do what I can to pay it forward and support the families of the others.
Sam Goodwin is the author of Saving Sam, a book out today that details his disappearance in Syria and his family's fight to bring him home. Sam, thank you for coming back to talk with us, and congratulations on the release of your book today.
My pleasure. Thanks, Elaine.
Today's segment was produced by Aula Kuziz.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.